Hello and welcome to The Eternal Debate. I'm Rachel Carline.
And I'm Andy Floyd.
Right, so let's jump straight in. We...
Jump straight in? Dive straight in would be more appropriate.
That would have been our... I already want to be like start over because I feel like I missed a perfect opportunity. So we've
already
done...
We must keep moving forward.
We must. So we've already done a part one for Edema. Water.
O-E-D-E-M-A.
Water everywhere.
Water everywhere.
So
I'm sure that was a Samuel Coleridge Taylor poem, and it was followed up with not a drop to drink.
I didn't know. I've heard that as a saying, but I didn't know.
I might be wrong.
It's origins. It
also the lyrics of an Iron Maiden song, I believe.
Hmm. How on brand
Rhyme
for
of
you.
The Ancient Mariner. Have we gone off topic already?
Already. Right.
Edema.
Okay.
We're talking edema. Water.
So hopefully...
Fluid. Accumulation.
Hopefully people have listened to the first episode.
Of course they have, Rach. So why wouldn't they? Why would they listen to a part two if they hadn't listened to part one? Craziness.
I mean, I am guilty of doing that sometimes, so I'm not going to judge. Anyway, in the first part, we talked about intracellular edema. And we talked about extracellular edema. So just to reiterate, intracellular.
Hard state, solid form.
Within the cell.
Indeed.
Extracellular.
Without the cell.
Oh, I thought you was going to describe
outside it. Outside the cell.
You went rogue then. He's so unpredictable. But the key thing that we were taking away from the extracellular.
10.5 litres, natural.
I feel like you're just shouting random facts.
They're random facts from the episode one.
Yes, they are. So intracellular, just to quickly recap, as an embalmer, we can embalm as normal.
Don't kick yourselves, guys. There's nothing you can do about intracellular edema.
Yeah, so we're not going to be able to change.
You can embalm the body just as normal.
Yes.
You're not going to change the aesthetics by way of reducing the... solid state.
Perfect. Wonderful. So for this episode, when we're talking about treatment, we are focused on the extracellular.
The accumulation of the fluid in the interstitium.
So without further ado, let's begin by talking about when a deceased arrives in our care, recognizing that they're are presenting with edema, and what can we do early first steps to start working towards how we're going to treat the edema.
So we got to appreciate in the first instance that the embalmer might not be there when the deceased brought into care.
No, then that is quite common.
Mm.
Well, really common.
So the personnel that represent the funeral directors that look after the deceased in that first instance, it's important that maybe they recognise signs of edema as well.
Yeah.
Or even if they have a suspicion
yes.
that there might be accumulations of fluid,
yeah.
Particularly when we're talking about peripheral, arms, legs, for example, then... an understanding that gravity will be a real help to both the deceased and the embalmer.
Yes.
In that
instant.
Initial period.
See, I'm quite fortunate that the team that I work within now are really good at recognising these things. So we are usually in a position where we can, you know, raise the legs, raise the arms. When I say these things as well, they've come to the understanding that if we're going to raise someone's arm so that, you know, if there's edema in the hands, we're not going to tie the hands together and tight. We're not going to trap that edema in. I think
we need to qualify what an effective raise would be and the reason why gravity does have an effect.
Yeah.
And this really follows on from how we left episode one. We talked about why we don't slosh fluid around our bodies.
And I forgot what the word bristles was.
And we introduced you to the glycoprotein, which is the protein within the interstitium that holds our fluids in place. Now, edema, of course, is when those glycoproteins have been exceeded, their capacity has been exceeded. There is more fluid than protein that can hold it. So when that disease comes into our care, if they are subject to gravity, so if the limbs are raised slightly higher, it means that that excess is not held or bound by the glycoprotein. Therefore, it will follow gravitational channels.
So it will migrate to the lowest.
It will migrate to the lowest part. Or the lower. And ultimately, that can relieve the excess fluid content within that limb.
Yeah.
And it can accumulate the fluid within a cavity that might be more accessible to the embalmer.
Yes. So if we position the legs in a way that we can allow gravity to bring the fluid down from the leg into, the abdominal pelvic cavity, then when the embalmer aspirates, we have an opportunity or a chance
to access and relieve that excess fluid. Now, of course, the gradient is important.
Yes.
Because if the raise is only a slight gradient, then it's going to take longer for that fluid to eventually settle in the cavity that's accessible. The more significant the gradient, the quicker the action will take place. But I do think it's important that
we have
take
to be
into account the dignity and respect that we afford to the deceased. Because, you know, it's easy for us to say, well, if you effectively raise the arms vertical and the legs vertical, then yes, it's going to have a significant effect and it will be to the greater good of the deceased and the embalmer. But is it ethically right? And that is a question mark.
Yeah, I think we're all going to feel differently about that, aren't we? Now, for me, I prefer more of a middle ground in a more, you know, not quite vertical, you know, a more gradual raise.
Yeah.
And I know that that's going to have lesser of a...
But, you know, I'm sorry to butt in, but the key thing here is time efficiency.
Mm.
And if we manage expectations and we recognise that the deceased is presenting with the state of edema, then the embalmer should be the one that's coordinating with the other funeral personnel to say how long is a proper time to care for this individual.
Before we move on to that, because it is a nice time to do that, what I would also say as well is there's going to be restrictions as to how much of a raise you could get if, for example, if your deceased are in a temperature controlled environment, if there's any racking, or our hospital mortuary.
Yeah, so there'll be space limitations.
There's space limitations as well to how much you can do that. Moving on now to the when you start to manage those expectations.
Mm.
So for me, the minute I have a deceased arrive in my care who is presenting with edema, my first thing I will do is contact the funeral arranger or the funeral director, the person who's responsible for liaising with the family and looking after that family, the loved one's family. And I will, at that moment, begin to explain that this person is not going to be, it's not going to be a 24-hour turnaround. This person isn't going to be embalmed, dressed in a coffin and ready for viewing, not in that time frame.
And nor should they be, because that's not right for the individual.
No.
We, as embalmers, we stand up for the rights of the deceased.
Yeah.
We know what's best for the care of the deceased. Therefore, we are responsible for relaying that over to the other professionals as well within.
Yeah. Well, we have to advocate for them, don't
Indeed.
We? The other thing that I'll also do, not just from a time frame point of view, but from a clothing final presentation point of view, what I recognise when I have someone, especially if they've got, you know, quite excessive, you know, edema, it's not just, you know, mild, I will recognise very early on that clothing-wise, this person is going to need additional measures after the embalming. So there is a likelihood that there's going to be a degree of wrapping or the use of like an edema suit or a Unionol.
So I think it's true to say there must always be some form of containment measure as a precaution.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm going to put myself out there and say it, and I know we've had this discussion previously, but I believe every edematous case has the potential to still release fluid post-embalming. And I think embalmers have to realise that there is no 100% successful fix to embalming a generalised edema case.
Yeah.
I would suggest, can effectively work towards a 70% certainty, I don't want to use the word certainty. I think a 70% confidence that we will have arrested the possibility of fluid leakage.
Yep.
But we always have to recognise that there is a 30% chance that we will be defeated on that. Or
in terms of edema, embalming is always going to provide benefit.
Absolutely.
You're always going to be able to improve, or lessen, should I say, the amount of fluid that has potential to leak. You know, embalming is a control measure in that respect. However,
70% is significant.
Yeah.
You know, if you think if we didn't do it, then we're really looking at catastrophic results with regards to the condition of the deceased.
And
quite
it can
soon
happen really
death.
Quickly. Yes, exactly. Absolutely. That's what I was just about to say. So from from a precautionary, what I'm thinking at the end of the embalming treatment, what's going to be needed? So then to begin to manage the expectation of clothing. So if the family haven't already brought clothing in for the deceased, you know, having that discussion about having something that's long-sleeved, something that's high neck, full leg covering, so, you know, trousers or a long skirt, feet covered, whether that's with, you know, it could be socks or so full coverage, really. If the family have already provided with us an outfit, I will have a look at what they've provided, and then I'll go back to the front of house, so to speak, funeral colleagues, and then I'll say, this is what we've got. Would it be possible to either substitute this or bring in additional items to give us that coverage? So we're really managing that expectation.
And that's key. If families have already brought certain items of clothing in and we are just looking for suggested additional pieces, then we can also take into account that there are things that can be done within the presentation of the coffin that can help, you know, to disguise the way the coffin frills are positioned, for example, a sympathetic covering could be put over the from the waist down, for example, that, you know, people aren't necessarily seeing these additional measures that we will have to implement that might not be as aesthetically pleasing.
But I think as well, it's
should be
really
explained.
Exactly. That is exactly what I was just about to say. Because if you do something, so for example, covering from the waist down, if you do something like that without an explanation, that in the mind, if a family then comes to visit and that's not explained, that can breed so many thoughts in their mind.
It arouses suspicion.
It does. And they might not feel comfortable to ask. Mm-hmm. So we're the professionals. We're the ones that should be guiding and explaining these, you know, these things. Being open and honest.
Because as professionals, we'll be much more respected if we're as you say, open, honest, and explain the reasons why we have to do things,
yeah,
than if we just try to make assumptions that nobody will think twice about it.
Because also it allows us to put the family in a position of control again. So we are then in, you know, if we discuss options with them, would you prefer to provide, for example, would you prefer, so we've got a lady who's wearing a dress that comes to the knee. Would you prefer for us to cover her from the waist down, or would you prefer to provide trousers? And then at least there's still that, we're still managing the expectation, we're still carrying out the care that the deceased needs, but they're also feeling included in that decision process.
And we're affording them the control.
Yes, perfect.
Indeed.
So then, moving on. So we've already looked at gravity and how that can help. So we've brought the deceased into our mortuary now, and we're preparing for the embalming process. So quite a lot of things here we can discuss in the pre-embalming assessment.
One thing that I would also suggest, because it's to do with this initial receiving of the deceased, mm-hmm, from wherever they've come into our care from, if we have a situation where a deceased is being received in a body pouch, for whatever reason, then I think it's important that they're removed from that at the soonest opportunity.
Yeah.
Because the condensation that can form within that will only serve to make a situation worse if we're talking about an edematous case.
Yeah, that is a really good point. So with regards then to the pre-embalming assessment, once the person's in front of us, so there's a few things here that we really need to consider. So for me, during the initial observation, I'll be looking at if there's any pressure, which is going to give us that extra vascular resistance. So, for example, if we've got ascites.
So we talked, didn't we, in the last episode about the types of edema.
We did.
So we don't necessarily have to repeat that ground, but one of the key things that's worth reiterating is that if you have accumulations of edema in localised areas,
mm-hmm,
particularly with the serous membrane effusions, that type of edema, if there's a solid structure around it, you might not necessarily be able to notice it from an observation, yep, point of view.
Yes.
Because of the inward nature of the...
So, for example, pleural effusion, lungs were within the rib cage, we're not going to be able to see that.
That's it. But with regards to the abdominal cavity,
mm-hmm,
because it is described as a soft structure, there's no hard boundary wall, then that will be a very noticeable type of edema.
Yeah.
It's what we refer to as ascites or peritoneal effusion. It's, well, we've referred to it in the last episode as being like a waterbed effect. Mm-hmm. That's the haptic feel that you can associate with it. But we've got to appreciate that pressure of fluid will be pushing downwards on the vasculature in, yeah, the body, and that's going to cause a resistance, what we call an extravascular resistance. So an embalmer during the pre-embalming analysis should be seeing this, realizing and understanding that the accumulation of the fluid is within the peritoneal serous membrane, and there's no vasculature within that membrane. Therefore, we can make a very small incision,
yep,
and we can use a blunt-ended aspiration tube or trocar in order to relieve,
yeah,
that accumulation of fluid, relieve the pressure on the vessels, and that's only going to make for a better distribution of the arterial fluid during the embalming process.
Yeah. Yep, so that's definitely something then during your pre-embalming assessment or analysis, as you just called it, is something that's going to be really beneficial if you can recognise and complete. So the other things then that I would be looking at, I would be at that point making a decision on my injection site.
Mm-hmm.
So personally, I always use a restricted cervical injection.
I would agree with you 100%. I think for any suggestion of edema
mm.
within the body. It's key that we say within the body, because we should reiterate that it's rare for the head and the facial features mm. to be affected by extracellular edema, unless you're in a situation where they've gravitationally yeah. been on a certain side.
Yeah, which I have had experience mm. of in the past. You know, if somebody's arrived in a body pouch on their side and have, you know, I have seen it in the face, and, you know, and the eye was terribly affected.
Hmm.
But the repositioning...
can go a long way to...
Yeah, and it did.
Redistributing it did. And aligning that.
Yeah, it yeah. really did. And then, you know, I still treated the head separately. And then, but with like the massage and through the injection and through the resting and through gravity, it went a long way to being
yeah. So when rectified. We're talking about the employment of a restricted cervical injection, I think yeah. it's important that we just dwell on how that can be used most effectively.
Yeah.
I mean, the name suggests restricted cervical. That just means the vessels in the neck area.
Yep.
And principally, it's the common carotid arteries, the right and the left, that the embalmer would be looking to utilise. Generally speaking, but not exclusively so, the injection point would be proximally. Mm-hmm. That means towards the body on the right side.
Yes.
And only because you're in the same site there that gives you access to the right internal jugular vein,
yep.
which is best practice for drainage
yes.
from the right atrium of the heart, in slightly indirectly. But there is absolutely nothing to say that you couldn't use the proximal portion of the left in order to yeah. affect your
yeah.
your injection of fluid. But anyway, whether it's the left or the right, it doesn't matter. You're raising both of these vessels mm. anyway. But you do need to make sure that you restrict proximally the one that you're not injecting.
Yeah, so for example, through. if you're using your right, you need to restrict the left.
Mm-hmm. Which just means making a closure.
Yep. So if you wish to use, I personally use my ligature.
Mm-hmm.
Then with regards to the distal, so towards the head, I would intubate.
So we would generally use the catheter type tubes.
Yeah.
Those embalmers that are actively employing these procedures generally recognise the size as being the orange ended catheter tubes, because they are coordinated by or identified by colour as to what size the tubes are, but the orange ended ones are the appropriate size.
Yeah, the large ones.
But the importance of intubating distally on the carotids, and distally means further away from the middle, so it's going towards the head, is that you're holding open a passageway for fluid which won't be arriving from the head.
Mm.
Understanding the anastomosis, which we know as the circle of Willis,
yep.
we understand that there is a posterior route
yes.
which can channel fluid
yep.
through the vertebral arteries, which arise yep. from the subclavians, which are just in your, well, where the neck area transitions to the upper arm. And fluid can be diverted then to the head and the face. So even though you're restricting the carotid arteries proximally, yeah, still... you're not able to stop
no.
An amount of fluid going up towards the head. Now, the no. danger is if you don't intubate the distal portion of the carotids, you don't hold them open and offer a path of least resistance.
For the fluid to...
Then that fluid would be... Well, it would have no reason to flow in a certain direction. It would.
Do you know as well? This is something that, because once I'd qualified as an embalmer, but it was quite a while before I realised. Because I'd be like, I'm doing a restricted. Why is the fluid still getting in the face? And that it was just that simple
mm. It's a little addition that a lot miss out. Which...
Yeah. So inch a bit up or low, that's come out. Whilst on this topic, however, I do, when I'm doing these cases, I set the features before I start to inject. Just because if there is anything, and there will always be a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, that might make its way still into the face. Mm. That way,
little bit,
yeah,
shouldn't be significant enough to make a difference, especially after you've commenced your distal injection.
Yes, but.
But the key benefit of this technique is it means that we can formulate a solution.
Yes.
That will effectively, or most effectively, deal with the edema affected parts of the body.
Yep. Whilst keeping the face and the head
isolated,
which, because I always do a different
mix. Or different solution, yep. strength, yep. and makeup. For yep. when we commence that injection of the head.
Just before we go on then to making our mix,
mm-hmm.
The other thing that to be mindful of is, you know, the signs of decomposition.
Yeah, part of an analysis, certainly we're used to observing decomposition as being a reliable sign of death.
Yes.
McBurney's point, which is a point in the right abdominal quadrant where we know that the small intestine transitions to the large intestine. For those that aren't as anatomically oriented, it's where the appendix is situated, if you've still got one. but that is the first area of the body that, in death, will present with putrefactive signs, which is a green discoloration. But that won't be as evident in an edematous case, but it doesn't mean because you can't see it.
It isn't
that
happening.
It's not there, yeah. and it isn't happening. It's just the fact that the accumulation of the fluid is on top of it. Therefore, it's either going to completely disguise it, or it's going to dilute the discoloration down to what we could describe as being a very minty green colour, as opposed to a darker green that we would usually associate with putrefaction.
Yeah. So with that in mind then, let's start to talk about making our solution.
Mm.
So additional disinfectant.
Yeah, I would suggest if ever you see signs of edema, and in my opinion it doesn't matter how extensive it is, if you see signs of edema in whatever form, I would encourage that you use additional accessory disinfectant. Now, we talked in previous episodes as to what is in the different types of chemicals that are within an arterial solution. We've also talked about the fact that formaldehyde, which is the principal preservative, doubles up as a disinfectant.
Yep.
But in the situation of edema, we know that there is an increased fluid medium. We know that bacteria want a fluid medium. Mm-hmm. So straight away, that should tell us that the ideal situation for bacteria is already there. Therefore, they've had a head start.
Yeah.
Now, there's also an increased demand on tissue preservation. So we don't really want the formaldehyde to be trying to do all of the things it can do. We want it to do the thing it's best at.
Yes.
And we want it to dehydrate and to effectively desiccate the tissue so that it removes the fluid aspect and makes the area as inhospitable for the bacteria as possible. And let's leave the disinfectant to a purposeful disinfectant that's just added to the mix for the sole purpose of destroying what bacteria we can.
I thought you were going to say disinfecting then, and I was like, how many times can you say disinfect, disinfectant and disinfected in one sentence? But you didn't anyway.
And fluid. What ratio? I would suggest 100 mils per litre of solution being used. But remember, if you do employ a restricted cervical injection, then you're not having to do a full amount that you would do based on a case analysis of a
full
weight of an individual.
And whilst discussing weight, it's worth being mindful with an edematous person that it's the weight that they would have been
prior to any excess fluid. And I know there's a little bit of creativity involved here and a little bit of thinking on your feet, but it's the same principle as somebody that might be generously proportioned with adipose tissue. You know, we've said in previous episodes that carries very little vasculature. Therefore, it's not very sensible to work out a final amount of solution based on excess adipose tissue, because there's nothing to utilize for your embalming solution.
So, and same principle
applies. Yeah. There's no vessels in fluid. Therefore, there's no point accounting for the excess fluid when working out weight.
So with this in mind then, so we know that there's excess fluid there. So what we do need to consider when we're talking about our final strength and our index is the potential of a secondary dilution.
Well, I wouldn't even say the word potential.
Well, no, it's going to happen if they're edematous, aren't they? But
if you've got edematous deceased, you know, whether it's generalized edema, whether it's localized edema, in the area of the body, you've got the ability for your solution to be further diluted when it comes into contact with that fluid. So effectively speaking, it depends on the severity and it depends on the distribution of the edema. But I would suggest in situations of anasarca, which is the name we give to the generalized edema, whatever you're making up as your final concentration of fluid, you can effectively consider that to be halved the moment it enters the body. And of course, that has a knock-on effect on
preservative. So, for example, if you think you're going in at 6%, realistically,
the best you can look to achieve 3%. Is working towards a 3% working concentration. Which is not significant, really.
No, so I suppose that leads us on to, you know, what dilution strength would be comfortable embalming a body at. So I know I've talked about this in previous episodes, because I was certainly someone who was wary or cautious or had a very different of opinion of what high strength was. Whereas that's completely changed now. So I am comfortable going in at like a 10% for someone who's edematous.
Yeah, I mean, final concentrations of 10 to 12% should be considered because, again, like we've just said, if you halve that, you're taking that down to a 6% working index.
And this is where I'm really comfortable talking about how my journey has changed and my results have changed. Because when I was, you know, working at a lower overall, what the results I get now, you know, when I do treat an edematous body with indexes of like, you know, like diluted down to 10, 12%, it's much, much more effective. So I've seen that by growing into these
dilution strengths. Well, as embalmers, what we do is evidence-based.
Yeah.
Like, science is evidence-based. So, you know, nobody should ever just be doing things because somebody said that's how you should do it. You should see the effects. And if you're not seeing the effects, then don't be afraid to challenge what you may have been told. Because there are people out there that will consider a 3% final concentration to be a high percentage.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, when you've experienced the evidence-based results of 10 to 12%, it does make you, for want of a better expression, smile or laugh at how, you could ever attempt to deal with a situation like this at such a low concentration.
And that's definitely where I've been and where I've come to now. So I suppose don't be scared because it sounds
higher than what you're used to using.
Yeah.
Because if you embrace it and you see the results, then this will be how you are used to working moving forward.
Yeah, it does. It certainly did for me. I've adapted it completely. However, if we're talking about working at these strengths, it's only responsible for us to talk about doing this in a safe way. So having these safe...
In a supermarket.
Safeways. They don't exist anymore. Morrison,
they do not.
I'm sure Morrison's bought took them years over. Ago. Yeah. Mm. Anyway, so having safe working practices. So what's your ventilation like? Do you have a personal respirator? Mm-hmm. So if you've got drainage...
You should be draining into sealed containers.
So, yeah,
because it is worth saying that exposure to formaldehyde, even diluted down to a small amount of, 10 to 12%, it's noticeable.
Yes.
So, you know, you don't want to put yourself in any discomfort. So by making sure that you have the necessary precautions in place, you're only protecting yourself and the environment that you're working in.
So then, do we feel that now is a good place to just have a moment? Well, let's have a break.
I'm always having a moment.
You are.
I think we should just mention as well about the importance of the additive of dye.
For those that do use
that routinely. And I know it's something we advocate, and I personally do, and I think I'm right in saying you do too.
Yes.
But where it's we might consider 10 mils of dye to be appropriate for a full embalming, when you take the secondary dilution into account, you know, you've got to accept that...
It's going to affect your dye as
well. You're not
going to
see
it. Yeah.
So don't be afraid to up your concentrations of dye, taking into account the secondary dilution effect.
Yeah. And what I would say as well, the colour, some co-injections specifically formulated for treatment of edema can really negatively impact the presentation and the colour.
Right.
Afterwards, if you don't use...
A dye supplement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From personal experience.
Mm-hmm. But that's what it's all about. That's why we're discussing it.
So we'll allow a break, because then when we come back, we can really get into conversation now about...
The nitty gritty. Of the chemicals.
The chemicals used
And the mechanics behind them.
Yes. And why understanding them is a good thing.
Indeed.
We will be back very soon.
Did you know you can find The Eternal Debate on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter?
Be sure to follow us to keep up to date with future episodes or even suggest future topics.
And share us with people who you think might enjoy our content.
Welcome back.
Welcome back.
There we go. He's here.
I've got two, a left and a right one.
So we've talked about the strengths.
Muffled by headphones.
Not muffled in my ears, sadly. So let's talk about the edema fluids then, Andy, on the market.
Edema fluids. I think embalmers will all, any embalmer listening to this, will recognise the fact that there are edema accessory fluids available to them.
Yep.
What might not be so much of an assumption is for them to offer... embalmers in general, to understand how certain edema fluids work.
Yeah.
They're not all the same.
No.
The mechanisms behind them can be radically different in how they're designed to work within the body.
So the techniques that we employ as embalmers when using them can significantly impact the success we have with them.
With the fluids that we use. Yeah, and I think a lot of people get frustrated because it just says edema fluid, therefore the assumption is that if you put that into your solution, it will have a significant effect on reducing the edema, but not always so, because you've got to understand what the mechanism is behind that particular accessory fluid to know how to adapt your practices to allow it to work in the best possible situation.
Yeah. I think as well is... understanding the importance of using the fluids in the correct quantities as well.
Follow the manufacturer guidelines. It often states on the front of the bottle.
Yeah. The one I use, certainly says it on the label. And for a long time, well, I say a long time, after qualifying, I did not get results. And I went to a seminar where the quantities were discussed. Once I started using the correct quantities,
you world realized of difference. The effect.
Yeah.
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 So if we can really put the accessory edema fluids into two camps.
Yes.
With regards to how they work.
So we have our Epsom salt based.
So there are certain edema accessory chemicals out there that have no form of preservative within them.
Mm-hmm.
They have a high concentration of a salt.
Yeah.
Which is an Epsom salt ingredient. And what that serves to do is to make that chemical hypertonic. That means it has a higher than usual solute concentration within it.
Yes.
And we talked in the last episode, when we talked about sodium-potassium pumps, how sodium will always attract water.
Yeah.
Well, the Epsom salts have got a significantly high sodium concentration within them. So the idea behind this type of fluid is that when you introduce it,
it's going to draw the excess fluid.
It's going to try to draw the excess fluid from the interstitial space into the vasculature. And of course, for it to work effectively, you want to have that come back out into your drainage.
Yeah.
So there are two things here.
Do you know, I've literally just thought...
Literally?
Literally just, like, a little light bulb just came on over my head as well.
I saw it.
It
fizzed a little.
The other reason why I would have struggled so much was because I didn't used to use vein drainage.
Of course.
So
where was your...
So where was it
going
to go?
Withdrawn fluid going?
Because obviously I'd use a natrial tap, but that's in... Anyway, it will be drawn out during drainage.
But
carry on.
That's really just touched on one of the two things I was going to mention. Yeah. So that was the first thing. You must be correctly employing venous drainage to allow yourself an exit from the beginning... or from the beginning of the time when you're deciding you're going to employ this technique, this type of chemical.
Episode 3, vein drainage.
That's right. and then the other point as well is to effectively utilise this technique. It's my belief, although I know there will be some people that will argue this, and everybody, you know, it is an eternal debate, everybody's welcome to have their own opinion, but it's my belief that it's best implemented, in my experience, with a low pressure but a high rate of flow. Now, when I say that, I want you to visualize what that actually means. It means that the fluid won't have a great chance of being able to overcome resistances, but the rate of flow being high means it will flush fast through the vasculature. Now, with these Epsom salt based edema chemicals, there's no preservative, remember?
Yeah.
So there's no reason why we should be looking to diffuse this fluid over through the vasculature into the tissue spaces as we would with a preservative-based fluid like a formaldehyde-based arterial. Yeah. So, to scoot it through, if you like, the vasculature and out into the drainage, if it's moving fast past the tissue spaces, it's going to be dragging or pulling in the excess water which is held within the interstitium.
Yeah.
If it's dawdling... And going slowly through, it's not going to have the same attraction.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's the speed that matters.
That's going to pull it with it.
Yeah. Now, because of that, we should be putting two and two together and thinking, well, it doesn't make sense to use this type of accessory fluid with an arterial solution as a co-injection.
So it would make sense.
Or at least not from the beginning of your injection.
So either use it as a pre-injection,
which is the ability to use the vasculature before you introduce your arterial solution. So make up a separate mix for the sole purpose.
With the salt. Yep, with the salt first.
Flushing it fast through the vasculature to try and pull as much of that excess fluid out as possible. Or you can utilise it as a co-injection, which means putting it in at the same time as your arterial fluid, but don't add it until you're comfortable.
So don't add the product that has the salt, the Epsom salt.
Yeah, so the Epsom salt-based edema accessory chemical, don't add it until you're nearly at the end of your arterial injection. Because when you know and you're confident that the deceased has retained the necessary amount of preservative chemical,
then you can
safely, towards the end, increase your rate of flow and allow it to have that whip effect, essentially, to draw that excess fluid towards the end. So there are different ways you can employ it, but the key thing is understanding you need drainage.
Yes.
And you also don't want to put it in with your arterial fluid from the beginning.
Yeah.
Because then you're just asking to waste a lot of arterial fluid. You won't be giving the formaldehyde the chance to do what it needs to do. You'll be whipping it through and it'll be coming out into your drainage.
Yeah.
So they're the significant considerations with the Epsom salt based.
So the second type of edema fluid then is the glutaraldehyde based products.
Which work in a very different way. Mm. These type of edema accessory fluids tend to be more expensive because they've got more expensive ingredients in them.
Yeah.
Glutaraldehyde is another form of aldehyde, similar to what formaldehyde is that we use routinely, but glutaraldehyde is a more expensive ingredient. The Epsom salts from that first example, you know, the different example of fluid, salt, as we can appreciate, is a fairly easily sourced ingredient. So they tend to be more cost-effective fluids, the Epsom salt-based ones. But the glutaraldehyde ones, a little bit more expensive. So I'm saying that because it might help you to understand which ones are which, because we're purposely not mentioning product names.
And we understand as well it's quite difficult if you're listening. But if you are listening and you do want clarification, if you get in touch with us, we can, you know, we're happy to discuss.
Talk more directly.
Brand. Yeah, so, you know.
And more specifically.
If you use a specific brand and you want information on how we would use that specific brand, reach out. It's
absolutely
just for the purpose of the podcast. We do like to remain
neutral.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. So, glutaraldehyde, it's an aldehyde that should suggest it has preservative qualities to it, in the same way that formaldehyde does. Now, the difference is that formaldehyde has one functional aldehyde group, which serves, as we want it to cross-link and to bridge proteins, or the smallest constituents of proteins, which are the amino groups. The glutaraldehyde has the additional benefit of having two functional aldehyde groups associated with it. So I don't want this to become a science lesson like the first episode, the fundamentals.
Science with Andy.
But I want to get the point across that using a glutaraldehyde-based accessory edema chemical is going to increase the preservative demand, or ability, I should say. And it has the ability to form two cross links for every molecule of it used. So it's got a more effective dehydrating capacity to it than what the formaldehyde alone would. But then don't forget, we would be utilizing this accessory fluid as a co-injection with the arterial-based fluid, which likely is formaldehyde-based.
Yes.
So you're getting the best of both worlds here. You're getting the formaldehyde, which is like a rapid action cross-link, and you're supporting it with a glutaraldehyde product, which is double cross-linking.
Yep.
So this is where we can relate back to the end of the first episode, where we talked about the glycoproteins. And there was a reason we left that as the last thing that we talked about, because the glycoproteins exist within the tissue spaces, the interstitium. Extracellular edema is all about accumulation within the interstitium.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going back to the reason we don't slosh is because we are holding a certain amount of fluid within the glycoprotein.
Yep.
Now, if those glycoproteins were to degrade, which ultimately they will during a body deteriorating, then they're going to release the hold on that water. As embalmers, we don't want that. We want to fix those glycoproteins as soon as we can. But we don't want to dumb down, if you like, the effect that the formaldehyde will have.
Yeah.
So we want the formaldehyde to be able to get to where it needs to go, which ultimately is into the cell, to fix the proteins within the cells. But the use of the additional glutaraldehyde-based edema chemicals means that we've got that extra help in fixing the glycoproteins. What that should be suggesting to us is we've got a double whammy of maintaining the integrity of the cells within the body, which effectively maintains the integrity of the tissue, but also securing an amount of fluid within the interstitium. But notice that we say an amount of.
Yes.
We cannot pretend, and I certainly can't see any evidence to suggest, that there is any accessory chemical that can deal with, effectively, the excess that's not held by the glycoproteins. Now, you must consider the fact this is my opinion.
Yeah.
But until, you know, we are the eternal debate because we want to put these things up in the air. But to me, currently, this justifies why, as an embalmer, we can never expect 100% success rate in a fully anasarca generalized edema case.
Yeah.
Because other than employing the Epsom salt approach and taking some of that excess fluid from the tissue space, there doesn't seem to be any other medium for being able to. In fact, what it does do is give a justification for maybe the use of both styles of accessory edema fluid, which I'll honestly say I've never considered or never done before.
I haven't, but like you say, like, hypothetically, if you were to use the salt
as a pre-injection,
method as a pre-injection,
and then the glutaraldehyde-based as a co-injection.
Yeah, that would potentially, I don't know, maybe someone listening does do that.
Yeah, and if so, reach out and let us know. But I would still suggest that would take a 70% confidence to an 80% confidence.
Yeah, you still.
But I still believe that you've got to expect, and of course, the longer you're holding the deceased for, the more likely it is that, you know, edema will try to beat you.
Well, you don't know how long the person's already going to have been dead before as well. For us, obviously, we're UK based. So I know sometimes when I do receive somebody who is quite edematous, if they've perhaps passed away in a hospital or we've been waiting on paperwork, you know, sometimes, you know, we will see the fluid-filled, you know, blebs.
The bleb being a small version of a blister.
Yeah. So sometimes we'll already see
evidence that autolysis has taken place and we're already a step beyond in the decomposition process.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, it's worth just saying that autolysis in its own right as one of the fundamental parts of decomposition, that leads to a separation between the epidermis and the dermis, which is your top skin and your true skin underneath. And when that separation occurs, interstitial fluid will fill the space.
Yeah.
So the reason I've kind of just added that in is because if you've got an excessive amount of interstitial fluid,
yeah,
then it's only going to exaggerate a blister.
Yeah.
And allow a blister to form quicker,
yeah,
than it otherwise would. Because you've got a combination of there being a new channel for it to fill, the fluid, but also you've got to expect in that autolytic state, the glycoproteins have also started to deteriorate.
Yeah.
Releasing some of the held fluid anyway.
Yeah.
So whereas we normally wouldn't slosh, in this situation,
there's a degree of...
There is a degree of slosh. So, yeah. But it's all about understanding the chemicals you have, how best to employ them, and what combinations to use.
Yeah.
To get the most effective way of dealing with that particular case.
Andy, for the listeners, you'll have to have a go at using both. So
I'm really going to do that because I'll hold my hand up and say I've never done it.
So
I think it can only help.
Yeah. So I think if we park that for now, but you can update
report
us.
Back.
Report back.
Excellent.
So are you happy with where we're at with that before we take just another short break?
Yeah. We wanted to focus the centre part of this episode on those chemicals, because I think fundamentally, I know there will be a range of listeners, but we know that embalmers will be listening, and these embalmers are dealing, you know, face on with these problems, and we can say edema is one of the bigger challenges that faces the embalmer. I think we said in
bigger,
the first episode,
you know,
out of every 10 cases nowadays, 6 will present with it in some degree, in some form. So we really need to understand the most effective way of dealing with it.
So we'll take a short break, and when we come back, we can talk about aftercare and how we can take further precautionary measures. So we will be back with you shortly.
You can find all of our episodes at theeternaldebate.com.
Or you could subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, all major podcast platforms, and don't forget to leave us a review. Back in the room.
Yes. Welcome back.
Not used to having a second break.
I know,
quite
but
a luxury that.
We should have had a second break on the last episode.
I was filing my nails.
Yes.
Growing ever so long, you know. It's all that keratin.
We have received somebody into our care who is a dermatist.
Oh, halfway. Wait, I'll put my nail file down. I need to do some work. I've spun round twice on my spinny chair. I'm ready.
We've pre-assessed.
Actually, I haven't, because producer Si would be mad if I span round away from the microphone. He's nodding in agreement.
Yeah. Right, so we've pre-assessed.
What have we pre-assessed?
The edema case.
The edema case.
We've communicated with our...
Who with?
With our funeral care.
Oh, yes.
Funeral
colleagues.
We
did all of this in the first part.
Yes, I'm recapping, but you're just wittering. We've decided what strength, we've decided where we're injecting. We've injected all our... Embalming.
We've chosen the right chemicals.
We have.
We've employed them with the right techniques. We've understood the mechanics.
However, Andrew.
We've even used both.
But.
Uh-oh.
We need to treat the cavities.
Is this a big but?
We need to treat the cavities.
We do need to treat the cavities quite right.
So aspiration.
Mm-hmm. Which is a very important phase of the embalming process. And the aspiration phase is where during the arterial injection and the venous drainage phase, we've tried to take as much of the fluid out of the vasculature as possible. During the cavity aspiration phase, we are looking to try and take as much of the extravascular fluid out as well. Because don't forget, fluid is what bacteria wants. we remove as much fluid as possible in order to take the environment away from the bacteria. And at the same time, we aim to destroy as much of the bacteria with the disinfectant side of the chemical. So this is a phase that's really important and should be given, arguably, you know, as much time or approaching as much time as the arterial injection should take.
I think it's interesting as well because in my personal experience, what I've found, especially if someone, you know, if someone has, you know, been edematous, if I aspirate and make my way around, you know, all the cavities, but then let the body rest and then re-aspirate, I will usually remove more on you know, going around again.
Now, could that be, and this is just me putting the proposal out there because I think on my feet, could it be that the nature of the aldehydes and the fact that they produce water as a byproduct of their methylene bridge or cross-linking, could it be that because we accept that formaldehyde, glutaraldehyde will continue to work for about 12 hours afterwards, that is taking place? So even though we've aspirated fluid previously, we've got to allow the aldehydes to do what they need to do to firm and desiccate the tissue, but
as a byproduct of that, we have the water.
That's going to contribute to more fluid. Possibly, maybe.
It's a logical
theory, I always work on logic.
Interesting. But, yeah,
but either way, we need to make sure that the edematous person has as fluidless cavities as we have the power to affect.
And then for us to introduce our cavity treatment, so our non-dilute fluids that are specifically formulated for treatment of the cavities in that manner.
Yeah.
So after we've finished the embalming, then closing incisions.
Incisions, the embalmer has to be very mindful of in the edematous case. Certainly with generalized edema, it means that a lot of the tissue of the body is delicate.
Yeah.
Very delicate. So if you are looking to employ a suture of any kind, the tissue is not as, it can't offer as much resistance as what you normally used to. So when you do come to close an incision, it cannot be as desirable a final appearance as you want it to be. So that has to be taken into account. My experience is that the more peripheral area of the body the incision's made, the more difficult it is to try to affect the closure. But in these situations, we ask ourselves, do we necessarily need a suture-based closure? What are the alternatives?
Yeah, so this is something that I know I hadn't considered until speaking with you about these things. So what would you do?
So I, as an alternative, would look at using an effective cyanacrylate glue, which could be used to bond two surfaces together, so two ends of an incision together. There are activator sprays that can help to solidify that bond, and that would allow an initial effective closure. But you certainly couldn't just rely on that as being a sole closure, because there's a lot of manipulation of the body that still has to happen. Dressing the deceased is a good example of that. And it could easily be that that bond is disrupted in that process. So I would always, if using a non-suture-based closure, I would always further enhance the closure by wrapping the area. So I'd put a suitable soft fabric is the word I'm looking for, around the area of the closure, and then
Gone with an auxiliary or brachial?
No one else can see
what you're doing.
but then I would use a cling wrap in order to to properly secure that area.
Yeah.
That will also serve to keep the area dry.
Yeah.
And will allow then for clothing to be...
Well, I feel like this is a perfect time then to wrap it up.
And I like the use of the word and the expression.
So aftercare.
Yeah. I think we've said all through this, and we really have to keep repeating the fact that I would argue the best embalmer in the world, which I certainly do not profess to be, but the best embalmer in the world, I don't believe, could say hand on heart that a fully generalised edematous case would be completely prevented from leaking.
Yeah.
It's, you know, nature will always try to win, and there are sometimes situations where it's very difficult to stop it having its way.
Yeah.
But as I've said before, I'd have 70% confidence that we could get the deceased into a situation where we are being preventative against any further leakage. And
for me, I never wrap or place into an edema suit or anything like that immediately after.
No, a deceased should always be allowed to rest because, again, we've said the chemicals that we use will carry on for about 12 hours after the embalming itself. So you can't really assess the person properly until that time's concluded. And we've already said, when we talked about the aspiration, that an edematous case would require a re-aspiration anyway.
Yeah. So for me, I always keep these deceased in my care, you know, without them going off being dressed or being taken to any chapels of rest or anything like that.
But you said at the beginning, didn't you, that you'd manage that expectation?
I've already managed that expectation.
By letting people know what's right for the deceased in this situation.
So after I've allowed them that time to rest, I usually have a better idea as well of, you know, how much of a concern I've perhaps got of the potential for, you know, the edema to you know, make its way.
To continue to perfuse through the tissue,
And then that's at that point where I would either decide to wrap. Like a soft...
When we say wrap, I think we need to qualify
what that means, definitely.
There'll be a range of thoughts. Some people will be thinking Christmas presents, some people will be thinking, you know.
Yeah, so I use something that's, you know, it's like bandage width, and it's quite a soft like fabric-y, but it's kind of like what you would use if you've ever had your arm in a cast. It's kind of like the that's kind of the product that I would use, just so that if anything does come through, you know, there's something that it's gonna soak into.
Yeah, but I think as well as there being something that can absorb, that has an absorbency to it, there has to be something that's non-porous.
Yeah, so I would... So that would be my stage
covering.
One. Mm-hmm. My stage two would be like a cellophane, like a cling wrap.
Yeah. For those that are involved in funeral services listening, there is, in my opinion, an amazing product called Creme Film, which is a white plasticky material that's often used to line the internals of a coffin to keep it waterproof. Yeah. And the key there is waterproof.
Yes.
So by utilizing that material, you can effectively create your own edema suit. When we say edema suit, we're talking about a garment that could be as minimal as just a sleeve or a trouser leg, or it could be more comprehensive and it could be a full body wrap, is the expression we'd use, where we would completely contain the body within this garment. And it's a precaution.
Yeah.
It's a precaution, but it can be the difference between somebody's clothes becoming soiled with an aggressive edema that continues to perfuse and to sweat out of the tissue and be visible which then can lead to detrimental experiences in the Chapel of Rest, or it can be contained and not have that detrimental effect on the final presentation.
Yeah.
So even though I can appreciate it might sound to some as if it's quite an extreme measure, it's much better that it's utilised and employed.
Safe, so
it will save time in the long run.
So I'm looking forward to seeing this with you because various forms of wrapping, I've done, or buying the suits that are specifically made for this.
Yeah, because there are companies out there that do sell these. We call edema suits, and it's with the same end game in mind. It's containment. Yeah.
So so the ones that I have are basically it's like a onesie.
That's
with a zip up
how
the front.
You describe it,
but it's like a plastic onesie. But you can buy them, can't you? In like just the trousers.
You can buy any appendage,
so
containment sleeve or a containment leg or whatever.
I'm going on a learning experience this weekend. So I'm going to come and see what you do with
and
you.
And it's a special little surprise for the listeners as well, isn't it?
That's it. So
or viewers, as they will be in that context.
Yeah. The use of creme film, like I have never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So with all this said, we have a plan as well for our next podcast episode, which is the idea of waterless embalming, which...
I know we've not touched on that, and there'll be some people that have listened to this episode thinking, well, you know, when are they going to talk about the waterless approach to dealing with an edema case? Waterless is a little bit of a misnomer. It just means... an approach to your fluid solution that doesn't involve further dilute water, essentially, from the tap. But we do have to appreciate that any chemical that we use
has a
large water proportion as the vehicle within it. So a waterless solution is not truly waterless. But I can understand by not putting additional dilute in how that would be beneficial to an edematous case. But we are going to focus on that next episode because there's a lot more that can be said about the waterless approach. It is a very, very effective technique, if not a more expensive technique, dare I say, but it is effective. And you know, at the end of the day, if you want the right results, it's only right that we share the ways of achieving them with you.
So that's a wrap.
That's a wrap.
Same pun twice in the same episode.
Yeah, it's exhausted now.
I know, like me.
It is late, actually, in fairness. And we've kept producer Si up.
We have. He's ready for his pizza now.
He's nodding.
So thank
Off.
You.
Not in agreement.
So thank you for listening, as always. Any interaction, get in touch.
Please do. We
Any
have
questions?
Been. You are.
We have
We're
been.
All involved in the eternal debate.
Thank you and
good night.